This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. At the site of a new apartment complex in Durham, a bank of freshly painted murals was unveiled last month. It features a handful of heroes and muses who've called North Carolina home. Funk legend Bette Davis is there, as is fashion designer Andre Leon Talley. There's also a mural paying homage to one of North Carolina's most notable rap trios, Little Brother. Super producer Ninth Wonder and MC Big Pooh appear with the singer, rapper, and producer who rounds out the group, Fonte Coleman. The mural is a latest reminder of how much North Carolina reveres Fonte and all of his artistic peers. It is a not-so-subtle nod to his celebrity as a musician, actor, and producer, even though living in North Carolina allows him to keep a relatively low profile. Fonte Coleman joins us for the hour today to talk about fame, flying below the radar, and staying in the state of North Carolina when he could move anywhere in the world. Fonte, welcome back to the State of Things.
What's going on, Anita? Thank you for having me.
So good to have you back. You've been on our show a couple of times over the past couple of decades, but so good to bring you back in this especially interesting time we are all living in.
Very interesting time. But Frank is the homie. Frank Stacio, that's the homie. So anytime he call, I'm like, all right, let's do it.
So glad to hear it. So tell us a bit about your dedication to North Carolina, as we were talking about. I mean, you are a true North Carolina native son, born in the state, stayed, educated here. What keeps you in North Carolina after all this time?
Man, this is just home, you know. I've traveled, you know, just around the world. I've been fortunate and blessed enough to, you know, travel everywhere, you know, almost, you know, nationally as well as internationally. I've, you know, seen a lot of places, and you know, there was never any place that I saw or visited that made me say, okay, I can leave North Carolina. Like, this is better than me living here. And, you know, we would always say, even in Little Brother, that North Carolina was the fourth member of the group. Just living here just allowed us the space to really come into ourselves creatively. And, you know, there weren't a lot of distractions. It wasn't like, you know, it was a lot of nightlife or clubs or, you know, we didn't have, you know, like a big, it was like a New York or LA where, you know, you can just kind of get lost. It really just gave us the opportunity to just focus and hone in on our craft. And I just don't think, you know, a group like Little Brother or Foreign Exchange or just any of the you know, musical groups that I've been in, I just don't think any of them would be possible without me living here. It just really gave me that space to find out who I was creatively.
Well, and you talk so much about North Carolina, it comes out in a lot of your music, and I'd love to hear a bit more about kind of your family roots and how those also shaped you. I know your mom would always sing around the house, and you grew up singing in the church choir and playing the trumpet in middle school. So talk a bit about those early musical influences of yours.
Yeah, music was just always a part of my life, you know. There was never a moment in time where I thought about doing anything else. You know, this was just what I just always knew I wanted to do. I mean, there was never, you know, any backup plan or any other option. Like, you know, my English teachers, my English professors at Central would always tell me, you should have went to law school. You'd have made a great lawyer. You should have went to law school. And so, you know, that was, you know, kind of the only time I'd ever heard of a different career path, because for me, it was just always music. And so when I was a kid, you know, my mother, she would sing. You know, she would sing a lot around the house, and she still sings. And then I think my grandmother, she would make me sing in the choir at church, which I did not like going to church at all. but I was like, well, if I'm going to be here, I might as well do something that I enjoy. So I was like, I'll just sing in the choir. And so I would just sing in church. And then middle school, I got into playing the trumpet. And and the reason why I chose trumpet, I originally wanted to play sax, but at the time the rental, I think it was like $35 a week to rent a saxophone, but it was only like $20 a week to rent a trumpet. And so I just said, well, I'll just play trumpet, because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. And so I was like, well, I knew my mother can pay that $20. So I'll just play the trumpet. And so I just played the trumpet, and, you know, I ended up making all-state band. And, you know, I was, you know, first chair in the school band. Yeah, man. It was real. It was real competitive. So I just kind of did that. That was like, trumpet was the only instrument that I learned, like, formally how to play. I played a little piano and took some lessons and learned some theory. But the only instrument that I ever learned to play was trumpet. And then once I got to high school, I was playing football. And, you know, you couldn't do band in football. So I let it go. But the music was always there. And so that was just kind of my background and my roots. You know, my uncle was a DJ. He would just always turn me on to new music and have records laying around the house and would just let me explore. And I just thank my family for just giving me that opportunity and just allowing me to just roam and just kind of soak up all the music that was around me.
So in 2008, you released a project with your frequent musical collaborator Zoe called Zoe and Tigolo Love the 80s, paying tribute to being a child of the 80s, your love of that decade, being so steeped in this superstardom. So I want to play a quick clip from one of the covers on that album. You cover the classic 80s pop song, Take On Me. So let's listen. So that's Take On Me, as covered by Zoe and Tigolo. I'm here with Fonte Coleman, our guest for the hour today. One of the things I love about that cover is it really shows off your voice. You have a beautiful, beautiful voice. And I know you've you've leaned into kind of singing more than rapping a little bit as your career has evolved. But talk about kind of developing your sound as a vocalist and a singer. I mean, you have real soul to the way you sing.
Thank you so much, Anita. I really appreciate that. Singing was something that... honestly, I never wanted to do. I wanted more so to be a writer. And so, you know, when we were making the first Little Brother albums, particularly The Listening, you know, I would do hooks. And like one of the first hooks I did was Speed, which was like the first song we recorded. Mm-hmm. And it was just really just an idea I had. And I just kind of did it and put it down. And the idea was that I put it down and then someone else will come and sing it over or sing it better, you know what I'm saying, to me. But after a while, we just kind of put it down and it stayed there. And so, you know, I was like, y'all like this? And Pooh and Knife like, yeah, we like it. We think it's dope. I was like, all right, if y'all think it's cool. We'll just keep it, whatever. And so from that point on, that was when, you know, people started calling me to sing on stuff. And I still was just like, man, I mean, I'll do it, but I really wanted to write for other people. So by the time the second album came, we did Minstrel Show. That was when we brought in my man Darian Brockington, who's another Durham singer, another longtime friend of mine. We went to North Carolina Central together, and who was just an incredible powerhouse singer. And so for Minstrel Show, I was like, all right, I ain't singing none of this. Darian gonna sing all this. so that's why he's on like most of the hooks on Minstrel Show. But that was kind of how it started, just really wanting to write. And I think the kind of culmination of it all kind of started with Leave It All Behind, the second foreign exchange album that we put out in 2008. That was originally just a batch of songs. You know, I spent a couple years just trying to pitch songs and trying to be a songwriter. And that was really what I wanted to do. You know, I just remember looking at records as a kid and, you know, you would read the credits of the record and you would see the song title and then you would see the people in the parentheses. And I understood that, you know, I was reading and I learned, okay, 60s, those are the people, you know. So my thought was always, I want to be the guy in the parentheses, you know, because that's where the money is. You know, I don't need to be the guy on the cover. I want to be the guy in the parentheses. Well, and I think that's still who I want to be.
Yeah, I only have about a minute left, so we can talk about this bit more about after the break. But I mean, you did grow up listening to lyricists that really influenced kind of how you write and in that part of your style. Are there particular Southern hip hop artists or Southern rappers from North Carolina that influenced that? Or who were you listening to when you first started listening to hip hop?
Man, when I first started listening, I mean, I think it was just, you know, kind of just the meat and potatoes of what everyone was. I mean, it was LL, it was Run DMC, it was, you know, Fat Boys, Houdini. You know, it was just all the early 80s stuff that really was the line of demarcation between my parents' music and my music. You know, when I heard hip hop, when I heard Run DMC, when I heard, you know, Suck MCs, when I heard Big Daddy Kane, that was when I felt that this was me. You know, I had grown up listening to my parents' music, listening to Patti LaBelle and Luther Vandross and all the kind of soul R&B stuff. And I loved that and still do, but that very much felt like my mother's music. You know, hip hop felt like my music, and that's, it just took a hold of me and it never let go.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation just ahead, talking a bit more about the formation of Little Brother, fatherhood, family, and Fonte's other major musical collaboration, The Foreign Exchange. So stay with us as we continue our conversation on the state of things, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Fonte Coleman has been a professional recording artist for nearly his whole adult life. Beginning with a rap trio, Little Brother, it's led to a lot of trial and error, both professionally and personally. He's our guest for the hour today. He's been on the show a couple of times before with groups Little Brother and Foreign Exchange, and listeners can check out those interviews at our website, wunc.org. So you talked a bit about the beginning of Little Brother forming in college while you were all at North Carolina Central. But at that same time, yeah, you also found out you were expecting your first child, and you still graduated. You still graduated on time. So talk about how you managed that, the beginning of a musical career and becoming a new father.
Man, it was a lot. And that's a question. I'm glad you asked that, because that's not something that I get asked really at all. Yeah, it was really scary. I mean, it was one of the scariest times of my life, just realizing I was going to be a dad. And at the time, you know, we were working on, we hadn't even really formed Little Brother. We were just kind of working on songs just as a collective, like me, Pooh, Ninth, my homie Sean Don. Like, we were just working on songs just together, just making stuff. And, you know, I found out I was going to be a dad. And this was my junior year. It was towards the end of my junior year of college. And, you know, for a minute, you know, I thought about, like, just leaving school. I thought about dropping out, you know, very briefly. But I had an academic scholarship. And so I said, well, you know what? I'm going to just, I mean, it doesn't make sense for me to leave and just, you know, throw this scholarship away. You know, I'll finish it out. I only got one more year. And so the way we ended up doing it, I graduated in May of 2001, and my son's mother, her mom ended up keeping my son so that she could come back and finish. So she came back and finished that next semester. She finished like in the spring of 2000, 2001 or was it 2002? I can't remember. But she finished after me. So we were both able to finish. And during that time, you know, I'm just continuing just to work on songs and just kind of figure it out and just make records. And so by the time we formed Little Brother in 2001, my son was born in 2000. So by the time 2001 comes around and we're kind of starting to see what Little Brother is and, you know, we're forming it, it was really just faith, honestly. You know, it was just, you know, we were just making, we didn't know where it was going to go, but we just knew we enjoyed it. We felt that it was something that gave us purpose and we just kept going. And, you know, by the grace of God, it just all worked out.
How did you, I mean, I know you then went on to have another kid. You have two sons now. And I listened to a podcast interview of you talking about fatherhood, actually. And you, one of the things you said in there that really struck me is you said, family is going to be a part of my art, but never a part of my act. So I'd love for you to reflect a bit more on that and how you have kind of negotiated how to, you know, stay true to the vision of a father that you want to be, but also kind of have a professional career and then also acknowledge kind of who you are as a father in your work as an artist.
Yeah. You know, just, you know, being an artist and creating, you know, we're sponges, you know. I think being an artist is ultimately that you are a sponge and you just soak up, you know, everything that's around you, you know, whether it be good or bad, and it comes out into your art, you know. And I think that's one of the reasons why, just as a sidebar, I think that's why so many artists now are having problems like creating during COVID, because we're not really able to absorb anything. You know, like you can't go to movies, you can't go to restaurants, you know, you can't go to, you know, theater and see a show, you know, you can't really, it's kind of hard to have new experiences under these conditions, you know. And I think that certainly for me was a big problem early in the first couple months of COVID, where we were just stuck. I was like, man, I don't know what to write. Like, I have nothing to say, you know. But with my family, you know, it's just a thing of, you know, my oldest son, he's 19 and he wants to do music. And the great thing that I love about my kids is that they do not care what I do. It is the greatest thing ever. Like, they don't care. Like, I'm just, you know, I'm just dad to them. And that's it. You know, I'm just dad. And they know, it's like, okay, dad, I know you're kind of famous. Like, when we go out, people might stop and say something to you. So, you know, they kind of got used to that as being young. But I'm just dad to them. And so my part of just keeping them out of my act, you know, is going to come into the art, you know, is just the experiences I have as a dad. You know, I write about them and talk about them. But, you know, me, you know, bringing the kids and the wife out on stage and doing that kind of thing, you know, everything can't be for sale. And that was just something that never sat right about me. I always wanted to protect their privacy and give them the option to, if they want to play it up who I am and they want to do those things, then they can do that. But I'm never going to do that for them and make that decision for them.
All right, let's listen to one of the songs that you've done where you do talk a bit about fatherhood. This is on Kev Brown's 2005 album, I Do What I Do, and the track is Beats and Rhymes. Let's listen.
Give it to him like this, y'all. Check it. Even though they try to hate and defile us, they could never stop Tay from being the vilest. New Jack swinging, I break it down like Kyle West. Y'all can all be sure to put your dough where your mouth is and cop everything we come out with. Cause Kev beats turning, my rhymes burn like Auschwitz. Ziggins had their eye on Fonte from the outset. Cause I keep things simple and playing like Southwest on the higher heights. Put the mic down, but this is my advice. Cause Tay make the crowd say ho like Heidi Fleiss. Hands in the air and sun in these Ziggins. That makes me a parent. 4 years ago, my girl made me a parent. 4 years later, Kev's beats we be sharing. Going back and forth in the car, straight illin'. And they say I'm raising hell, I just callin' Dylan. And right now I'm chillin' at Kev's crib. Y'all know who the best is. When he dropped the beat and it bangs, drove up 95 with 16 in the bangs. And I'm out until y'all see me again. Smart ticker, come on.
24/7, 365, bring it to your live whenever we arrive. That's right, right. It's about that time to get in the state of mind. Yeah. Beats and rhymes again. Action packed. Yeah. Hit 'em with the hot dosage.
That's Fonte Coleman on Beats and Rhymes, a track from Kev Brown's 2005 album, I Do What I Do. I'm here with Fonte, who's our guest for the hour. So you can hear kind of you talking about going on tour and navigating fatherhood in that time. I mean, in that phase of your life where you were out on tour a lot. And then you also started foreign exchange. You were working on this other project. How did you manage all of these different identities, even just as an artist?
I didn't. I guess that's the easiest way. I did not manage it. I was just, that point in my life, that was like my early 20s. And the 20s are just such a time of self-discovery. And, it was a really hard point just in your life, just as a young man, trying to figure out who you are just as a person, alongside trying to figure out who you are as an artist. On top of trying to figure out who you are as a husband, who you are as a father. I mean, it was, you're fighting a war. You're fighting four different wars, like all on the same front. And it's really kind of maddening. But, that was the thing that kind of led it all, and just the spirit that drove it. I just always followed the music. And so that was really the only truth that I had at that time. I was very not very confident in myself as a father, certainly not confident in believing in myself as a husband. The only time I felt I got it right was in the studio or on stage. Like, that was the only time in my life where things made sense and I felt like I was actually contributing. And so when it came to just doing all the brands, when it came from, Little Brother, Foreign Exchange, Zone Tickler Love the 80s, just all that stuff, the joint with Kev Brown. I mean, that record is 15 years old. I don't think I've listened to it since we did it. but shout out to Kev Brown. We cut that in his house. But yeah, I mean, it was literally just, Anita, it was really just following the music. And that was the truth. And, anything that moved me, anything that made me feel good, and it felt like, it was just an expression of the truth, I would just do it. And that's kind of how I navigated it and balanced it all as best I could.
How did you know when it was time to make an album out on your own? You released your first solo project in 2011, Charity Starts at Home. What made you want to go out on your own at that point?
At that time when we did Charity, we did Charity in 2011. When I did Charity in 2011, Little Brother had disbanded. And up until that point, I pretty much had all my bases covered in terms of the things I wanted to do artistically. So, Little Brother was, kind of my hip hop side. And then Foreign Exchange was my, soul R&B, just kind of experimental side, I guess, if you want to say. And then, if I just wanted to just kind of cut the fool, me and Zoe, we do an 80s album. You know what I mean? So I kind of always had my bases covered. But once Little Brother disbanded, that was when I was like, I don't really have this hip hop lane anymore in Little Brother. So maybe now I can see what it is, for me, just do something for myself and just see what it sounds like. And honestly, Anita, I didn't think people was really going to get that record. I didn't, at the time when I made it, it just felt like it was something I just kind of had to get out and get off my chest. But after it was done, I was just like, all right, man, this might be too much for people. I might have said too much. It may just be too uncomfortable.
like too personal and too revealing, or?
Yeah, too personal, too revealing. I was like, I don't think, because at that point, people were used to kind of just hearing me in spurts. When you're in a group, you got one verse, you got 16 bars to get it, to say all you want to say, and you just kind of got to make your, but within a context of a solo album, now you have a whole canvas to fill. And it's like the difference between writing a short story to now you have to write an entire novel. And it's just like, oh my God. Like,
well, I imagine that felt super vulnerable, because if you kind of look back, almost every interview that you did for so long, the last question would be, when is Little Brother coming back? What's the deal with Little Brother? So to kind of like come out from under that and say, here I am, like, this is a project I'm doing all on my own. Did you feel like that was, I don't know, how did you kind of make sense of that kind of in the context of everyone really knowing you as part of Little Brother for a long time?
Man, it was, I think it was, I just took it into context of, this is the first time I'm getting to know me outside of Little Brother.
Hmm.
It was very much a process of self-discovery with me alongside the audience. That was my first time ever making something for myself. And so for all the people that were like, I wonder what a Fonte record sounds like, I was wondering the same thing. Like, I didn't know. I was like, I wonder what a Fonte record sounds like, because I've never made one. And so the process of Charity was a process of just me finding my voice outside of all the brands and all the, you know, the creative outlets that I had given myself to. And, you know, and it was really kind of scary, you know, but I learned from it. And I mean, the record was successful, and, you know, people, you know, they still hit me up about it. They love it. And I'm just so thankful for that. But I had no idea what people were going to make of it when I made it.
So 7 years after that record in 2011, you put out a solo follow-up called No News Is Good News. So let's listen to one of the songs from that. This is the song Expensive Jeans.
7 days in a week, eat a steak, every plate is a feast. Watch your weight, no mistakes in the least, or else you too will dig a grave with your teeth. I wish that I could fit in these expensive jeans, a waistline that'll rip the seams, and pharmaceuticals that sit between your heart medicine, cough medicine, blood thinners, and antihistamines. We got an oceanfront view, but the scope is so limited, cause young be dying of old. Wifey sleeping in the guest room because you snore at night. It's like 40 years old, it's three-quarter life. Our biggest fears were shots and armed robberies. Now the biggest fears are clocks and oncology. Got a sleep app to tell you you got sleep app. Me all, he all in your sheets with a CPAP. Wish that I could fit in these expensive jeans. I don't like this cut. It's like the Lord got my order wrong. 3 a.m. stress eating, laying down on it. Now your blood sugar is borderline, borderline. Seen them rise, I seen them fall. I seen the dreams of fiends and scenes of war. Inside my mind, it ain't nothing serene. It's called blackness, the most expensive jeans of all.
That's Expensive Jeans from Fonte Coleman's 2018 album No News Is Good News. He is my guest for the hour. Obviously, the clean version of that song. You heard some bleeps in there.
Yes.
So, I mean, you...
Yeah, I didn't know.
Go for it.
I didn't know. I didn't know so much y'all were going to play. I was like, okay. So I sent like clean stuff over, and I could have sent more, but...
All good.
You know, but
all
yes,
good.
My records are generally not NPR friendly, so I thank you for making the edit.
So, I mean, the industry has changed so much, and from the time that you released your first album with Little Brother to then releasing the second solo album in 2018. So what is it like to put out an album now? And I mean, what are the calculations that you are making in terms of the relationships that you want to build, the stuff that you want to do on your own?
Man, I think now probably the biggest shift in my life. And I was, you know, actually talking to my wife about this the other night, and me and Pooh, you know, rapper Big Pooh, my partner and little brother, we were having a conversation just about how I think the biggest shift is that when I was young, I was willing to suffer for the art, so to speak, right? It's that the old cliche of that, oh, a great artist, you know, you have to suffer for your art. You have to suffer for it, you know? And that's just not something I'm willing to do anymore. Like that is just not happening. You know, back, you know, in my 20s, you know, the first start of my career, you know, I would be willing to, you know, work with people that I probably didn't like, you know, just for the sake of making great music, or put myself in situations that probably were not the most conducive for me, you know, but it was just all in service of the music. Now at 41 is none of that. You know, my definition of success is being able to pick and choose my battles and being able to pick and choose the people I work with. And, you know, I just enjoy just working with people that I love and that I like. And so my thing now is no longer about just, oh, I'll do anything for the music. In my youth, I was so focused on the process. I was so focused on the end result, where it was just like, oh, man, you know, I'll do anything for the music. It's all about just the end result. As long as it's dope, that's all that matters. Now in my 40s, I'm more concerned with the process, you know, just the process of making the music and everything that we go through before, you know, before the music comes out. That's what's most important to me. And me and Pooh were talking about making Made a Lord Watch. And, you know, it's been a year, you know, it's changed since it's been out. And we just finally kind of had a chance to unpack all that. And we were on the phone that night, and I was just like, man, I really think about it. Making that album was one of the best experiences of my life, like, period, you know. And he was like, bro, I agree. He was like, yo, it was. He's like, man, just think about, you know, all we went through to do it, and just, you know, the traveling back and forth, and how we had to get samples cleared at the last minute. Like, you know, it was some great adventure type stuff.
Well, I mean,
but those are the things I cherish.
Yeah. I mean, the story of how that album came to be and how you all started collaborating together is so crazy to me, because it was kind of a happy accident that you all reunited, you and
right,
Pooh.
Right.
So maybe start telling that story and we'll have to take a break. But tell us a little bit about kind of how the reunion of Little Brother ended up happening in 2018.
Well, yeah, it started happening first when I got a call to do the Article Festival for my man Suleiman Mousy. Shout out to him. They hit me about doing a solo set. I was like, well, let me just see what I can do. I reached out, hit Ninth, hit Pooh, you know, see if they were down. They were with it. And so we pulled it off. That's a very abbreviated NPR version of the story. But that was kind of how it happened.
Yeah, y'all woke up one morning not knowing that you were going to have a reunion. And by the end of the day, the three of you were on stage in Durham at the Art of Cool Festival, which is just absolutely
crazy. That is exactly how it happened. I woke up that morning with no intention. A Little Brother reunion was the furthest thing from my mind when I woke up that day. I was just going to wake up, and me and my wife were going to go out later on that night, and we were going to check Nas and Erykah Badu. But God had other plans, so... it is what it is.
All right. We will hear more about that after we take a quick break, and then we'll talk to Fonte about a couple of more turns that he has taken in his career in recent years. So stay with us on The State of Things. Another shot, another man down. So I'm back on my Moby-ish. How you like me now? Back on my public speech. Talking to the crowd. Standing tall, front and center. When I'm finished, take a bow. Holla. And it's so complicated because I it's cool to be grounded, know what I'm saying? Just don't get used to being on the grind. Let's go. She keeps me so secure until I can't escape. So unpredictable, but it's all the same. It's all the same. So many nights I wish I knew the moment when your anchor turned into a ball and chain. And my man Swift Diesel. Yes. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, talking today with Fonte Coleman, a founding member of the rap trio Little Brother and of the Grammy-nominated R&B group The Foreign Exchange. In addition to working with both groups, he's also a solo artist and a music producer for TV and film. So right before the break, we were talking about Little Brother coming back together, a surprise appearance on stage at the Art of Cool Festival that led to the collaboration of the album that you spoke about between you and Pooh, May the Lord Watch, in 2019. And this comes after, you know, many years of distance, kind of strains in your friendship. I'm curious about what it was like to rebuild while also making that album together. How did you all kind of bridge your friendship?
It was a beautiful process, and it was a record that we had to live. And so, you know, when we started it, when we agreed to, you know, start doing it again, you know, me and Pooh, the thing that we were adamant about was that we're going to do everything together. So Pooh would come up from Charlotte and would basically move in. You know, he would come and, you know, stay in like one of my guest rooms, and, you know, we would just move in together, and we practically were living together. And so we did everything. We ate together. We would, you know, go out, and we would just listen to music. And we really had to relearn each other. And that was the biggest part, you know, of just, you know, the last time we recorded previously was, you know, 10 years ago, you know, 9 years prior. And, you know, we both had different experiences, and we had to allow, you know, for those experiences to speak through the music. And, you know, that was the biggest part of the process. And it was just amazing. It was like, you know, learning something again, you know, for the first time, like rediscovering someone and just being able to look at Pooh and just see how much he had grown just as an artist and his management and, you know, things that he was involved in. it was just amazing to watch and for us to kind of go through that together. And that's why I said earlier, just making that album, that was one of just the best experiences of my life. And I'm just so thankful for it.
Well, also, I mean, you all are at such a different phase of your lives now. You're in your late 30s, early 40s. And I mean, you're part of this cohort of rappers that are aging and that are still kind of creating music, but it's not about that, you know, 19, 20, 21 year old phase of your life. So how does that inform kind of what y'all are writing about and how you approach the process?
I think it, you know, the great thing I think about MCing and rhyming is that it is not something that declines as you age. You know, it only sharpens if you continue to sharpen that tool, you mm-hmm. understand? So, you know, it's not like being a basketball player where it's just like, all right, my knees at 40 versus my knees at 20 is just, you know what I'm saying? It ain't the same. But, you know, as an artist, in my opinion, I think, you know, the older you get, again, if you continue to sharpen that tool, I think you only get better because you have more to talk about. You know, I mean, this is the same thing I hear a lot of comedians say. We interviewed Chris Rock on Questlove Supreme like a couple years back. And he was saying kind of the same thing of just that, you know, when you're a comedian in your 20s, you know, you don't really have a lot to talk about. You know, it's just kind of, you know, you might make, you know, sex jokes or whatever, you know, just silly stuff. But it's not until, you know, you done been divorced, you done been bankrupt, you done, you know, your mama done did something to you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and you get like in your 40s, like that's when life really starts to show up and it just gives you a wealth of material to write about. So in terms of aging as a rapper, it is totally not the same as aging as an athlete. If you continue to sharpen the blade and continue to read and just continue just to kind of be that sponge that I spoke about earlier, you can really turn that experience into some incredible songwriting.
After having gone through some of those creative differences, did you all set boundaries differently or kind of think about, you know, how you wanted to rebuild this relationship as one that was going to be able to, you know, withstand whatever happened with the release and the evolution of Little Brother in this new iteration?
Absolutely. Yeah, we definitely set boundaries. We definitely set boundaries, and really it just started with us just having conversations about things we wanted to happen or things that we didn't want to happen. So one of the big big ticket items that we discussed early on was in terms of picking production for the record. And, you know, in the past, doing Little Brother albums, if there was a beat that I really liked and Pooh was just kind of whatever about, I'd be like, all right, man, well, yo, let's just do it. And he would do it. Or if it was a beat that he was really gung-ho about and I was like, I don't know, but, you know, I'll do it. For this go round, we just decided, you know what, I don't care if I think a beat is the greatest beat in the world or you think a beat is the greatest beat in the world. If we both don't agree, it's out. You know, and that was just, we was like, yo, if we both ain't on the same page, if I don't care if I think it's amazing, if my brother ain't with it, then we ain't doing it. And that was just something that really just kind of welded that bond even more because we were in it together every step of the way, 100% from top to bottom.
So aside from all of this music, you have been working on a podcast that you mentioned. You've also done a ton of voiceover work. You even ended up on Sesame Street as a rapping banana and a rapping hiking boot. So we're gonna play a clip of you as a rapping hiking boot, and then we're gonna talk about that process. So let's listen.
Absolutely.
Let's take a hike with hiking boot.
You can hear the sound. Put on some sunscreen to protect your skin and watch all the trees blow in the wind. And if you feel sad or you feel stressed, take a deep breath, smell the air, it's fresh. Drink lots and lots of water, please don't forget. And you don't have to walk alone, you can take your pet. And if you get tired, it's no surprise, cause going for a hike is good exercise. If you live in the city or you live in the town, just go for a hike and move your body around. Get right and take a hike.
Okay, so that's Fonte Coleman as a hiking boot in a 2020 episode of Sesame Street. How the heck did you get to be a part of Sesame Street? What was that experience like?
Man, that was the dream of a lifetime. My man, shout out to my QLS, my Questlove Supreme brother, Bill Sherman. Bill is one of the co-hosts of Questlove Supreme, and he is also one of the people behind a little known local play called Hamilton. And so he's one of the guys, him and Lin-Manuel, they went to school together at Wesleyan. And so they have a long bond and, you know, they've been homies forever. So so Bill is, he's one of the co-hosts of Questlove Supreme, along with Amir and me, Laia, Sugar Steve, the whole crew. And so I reached out to him and, you know, we were doing the show together and he was just like, man, you know, you want to write songs for Sesame Street? And I was like, dude, I would love to write songs on Sesame Street. You kidding me? Like, that's, yes. And he was like, okay. And so that just started just kind of our partnership of just him reaching out to me and say, hey, I got this thing. You know, you want to do it? You want to write it? You want to voice it? Whatever. And that was how it started. And so I, you know, written a lot of songs for them over the couple years. And that was one that I just did recently with the rap battles. They do like this thing where Elmo has they have a rap battle, you know, with Elmo. And so the first one I did, I was a banana. So it was a smoothie battle. And so it was apple versus smoothie. And, you know, Elmo wanted a healthy snack. So they had to decide which snack was the healthiest. So the apple versus banana, we battled each other to see who was the healthiest snack, you know.
What is it like? What is it like being these, like writing for these characters? Because it must be different, but it's still so tight lyrically. Like you can tell there's a lot of skill behind these raps in the same way that there would be behind something on an album.
Thank you so much, Anita. Honestly, it is so much harder than people think. It is so much harder, you know. The biggest lesson I learned just, you know, kind of from Sesame Street, and it also just echoes something that I heard from George Clinton. You know, we interviewed George Clinton a while back, and he was just talking about the early Parliament catalog and just Parliament Funkadelic. And I mean, and these are records that, you know, I worship, you know. And he was just saying that, you know, basically they were just trying to write nursery rhymes. He said that was our thing. He said we were trying to write nursery rhymes. We wanted to make it as simple as possible. And I was just like, oh my God, like he's right. Like all that stuff, it's just nursery rhymes. And when writing for Sesame Street, I think one of the biggest things that it just showed me was just how hard it is to really be simple. Like simplicity is, as a songwriter, simplicity is the hardest thing to do. And when you're writing, you know, I would send a draft, I would write a draft, and you know, I'm a rapper, so I'm like, yo, these kids about to get these bars, son. I'm about to wrap these kids under the table. Like, you just ain't ready. And I would send a draft, and Bill would send it back. He'd be like, okay, yeah, man, this is good, but you're writing for five-year-olds. And I'm just like, okay. You know? And so I would have to walk it back. And, I mean, simple, like things that you don't even think about, but super simple. Like, A is for apple, B is for ball. Like, you really have to make it that simple. So it has to be very simple, but it also, you know, it's got to jam. It's got to be a jamming song. So that has been writing for Sesame Street and doing stuff for TV. Also, Sherman Showcase, which is another show on AMC with my brothers Diallo Riddle and Bashir Saladin. Me and my partner Zoe, we do a great bulk of the music for that. And that was just, has just been another lesson, and of just keeping things simple. And also, just really giving me thicker skin as an artist. I think this was not a job that I could have done in my 20s because I was just so, you know, personally involved in everything. But writing for TV just really showed me was that, listen, either a thing works or it doesn't. And if you write a song and it doesn't work, it doesn't mean that you're terrible, you're the worst songwriter ever, and that you're talentless and you suck. Nah, it just means that this thing doesn't work for that. But so just give us something that does. And it totally allowed me to just disassociate myself from the personal part of the process of just saying, listen, if I write a song and it doesn't work, I can just write another song. And I have the ability and skill to just turn that out. And that was a big source of confidence for me, of just knowing that if you get rejected, it's not the end of the world. You just write another song.
We're going to end up closing out the show with a clip from Lyric Jones. And I know that you've been doing some production work for other artists right now, including Lyric. So I'd love to kind of know what you are liking about that role and how that is stretching you creatively to work with other artists on their music.
Man, Lyric Jones, she's a rapper, singer, songwriter. She's based out of L.A., originally from Boston, but she's been in L.A. for like the past 9 years or so. And she's someone that, you know, has been on my radar for a while. And, you know, we met like last year, and we were just, you know, we were talking about music and everything, and I just said, I'm like, okay, listen, I'm doing your next record, like, that's it. And that was just the thing. So we started working on the record around February of this year, and you know, she came out, we recorded a couple songs here. COVID hit, and it just kind of threw a big wrench in everything. So we had to finish the record kind of foreign exchange style, you know, where, you know, she was in LA, I'm over here. And I'm trying to, you know, put out fires from 3,000 miles away, and we're trying to figure out kind of what it's going to be in the midst of a pandemic on top of all this. So we got it done. And, you know, me working with other artists, you know, my thing is just always I try to be the person for them that I wished I would have had at that point in my career. So in working with her, you know, as an executive producer, when I executive produce a project, I'm pretty much just like a Swiss Army knife. So I can be as involved, as much involved or as little involved as you want me to be. So if that includes songwriting, if that includes background vocals, if that includes, you know, some rhymes, I mix, A&R, like I kind of, you know, I kind of do it all. And, you know, it was just the album. It comes out, you know, the 27th. It's called Closer Than They Appear. And I'm just super happy and proud of it. And it is just, it feels good to just be able to pay it forward. And just to really give artists just the game and opportunities that I didn't have, you know, when I was coming up.
As you have this moment of the pandemic to reflect, even though you've obviously been working on a lot in this process, is there anything that you're excited to work on next or a direction that you're excited to lean into in your career?
Man, yeah, I think, man, I think now, like this year, I mean, this has been the... This has been the first guilt-free vacation I've ever had in my life. You know, I mean, I can't, you know, I mean, outside of just the kind of pandemonium and just all the uncertainty that, you know, this virus and, you know, our, you know, leadership and presidency has caused, you know, as a result of it, you know, I just think this was just a time for me, just a reset and just really to just kind of sit and figure out kind of what that next step is. And so for me, I'm certainly looking forward to doing more TV. We got season 3 of Sherman Showcase coming up. We're starting to work on that now. You know, Lyric Jones's record is coming out. I'm kicking around ideas like for my next project, and also got another project I'm executive producing that's coming soon, I'll be announcing later on. But yeah, I'm always busy and working, but I think now I'm just thankful just to be able to pick and choose my battles. And that was something that for so long, as a quote-unquote starving artist, you just think you have to take every gig because it really is survival, you know, and it's do or die. But I just probably had a revelation maybe like a couple, like 2 years ago. I was up for a job, and I sent the paperwork to my attorney. And before he sent it back, before he even gave me any notes on the contract, he just said, dude, do you want to do this? And that was the first time I really, in a long time, I had ever had the freedom to even consider that question, you know, because after for so long, just, you know, you're making it as an independent artist, it's just, yo, take every job, do what you can, just hustle, hustle, hustle. But that was the first time I really was able to sit back and I was like, you know what? I don't. Like, I don't want to do this at all. Like, I don't care about the money. I don't want to do this job. And I'm lucky enough to have the ability to turn it down. And so now that is the way I operate. You know, if something doesn't excite me, if it doesn't move me in some way, then the payday doesn't matter. I just don't do that job. And it feels good to finally, after 20 plus years, to be in that position. And I thank God for it.
Well, thank you so much for all of the work that you have put out and for taking time to talk with us today. Fonte Coleman, a founding member of Little Brother and Foreign Exchange, as well as a solo artist and music producer. You can find links to everything we've talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. Fonte, thank you so much.
you, Anita. And shout out to Frank Stacio. You know what I'm saying? I know you out of the building right now, but I want to shout out my man, Big Frank. You know, shout out for always showing me love over the years and State of Things. Yo, this is my favorite NPR show. I'm always thankful to be here. Thank you so much.
Oh, of course. We'll definitely tell him hi. Thank you so much. We're going to close out the show with Show You How that Fonte produced for Lyric Jones featuring Vic Mensa. Let's listen.
I heard it all before. Shit ain't always sunshine, gotta make it pour. So can you make it rain down me on all fours? Take me to your playground, swinging off course. I'm a sheep in wolf's clothing, the choice is yours. Put me to sleep only when you eat the course. I require a different blueprint, let me take over. Let me show you all I need, you can thank Hova. This ain't a cookie cutter love, but this cookie got that butter love. What's next under the cover run? We the best, getting another one. Both sweat, just bless me over with your tongue. Simon says, just climb the bed. On that Jameson, showtime ahead. So let me chime in and make my case so you can touch me, tease me in the right place.
Show you better than I can tell you. Hey, you taking pics, making flicks, dancing like you Shakira, but the way you shake your hips, magnetic. Your sweetness is dangerous like a diabetic. I'ma stretch it out, you need a paramedics. Mouth to mouth, come out your blouse, your mama's house. Clap it like a thundercloud, you run around. Capping your friends about, how I put it on, you made you scream and shout, ouch. Can you take the on all fours? Jump on it doing tricks like parkour. Take it to the hole, no par four. Dark skinned, look like she from Darfur. I like an epic gal, all natural. Let me hit her from the left like Pacquiao. Boom, 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 till you're tapping out. Now let me hear your talk nasty now.